You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, as they say, parenting doesn't come with an instruction manual, but now it can come with free advice and guidelines right to your phone. A new text service is available in Wisconsin to help parents and caregivers with the challenges of raising children. The United Way of Wisconsin recently announced a partnership with Bright by Text. That service provides free info and advice about pregnancy and about raising children through age 8. It was released earlier this month in connection with the National Association for the Education of Young Children's annual Week of the Young Child. Rebecca Levy is the Program and Systems Director for Bright by Text. She works directly on this partnership with United Way of Wisconsin. Rebecca, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the basics. How does Bright by Text work?
Yes, Bright by Text is a national texting platform. We curate content from national trusted experts to support a whole child, whole family approach to early childhood. With that, we are just really committed to contributing to a world in which every child and family can thrive. And so that's why through our text messages, we share helpful information and activities on topics such as physical and mental health, social, emotional well-being, safety, brain development, connections, encouragement, and more.
So if I'm a parent who signs up, my kids are a little past the age range here, but if I was a parent who signed up, like how much am I going to be flooded with texts? What is the information flow like?
Absolutely. So we have a couple of different content streams. The first is what I just described, those curated content messages, which are delivered based on the child's date of birth down to age of life. So a parent taking care of a 206-day-old baby versus a 500-day-old baby will receive different messages. And then we also partner with organizations like the United Way of Wisconsin to bring local resources, services, and information to parents and caregivers as well. And so we're able to really collaborate on a local level to ensure that families are getting information on library story times, on diaper banks, community baby showers, food banks, and more.
Can you talk a little bit about the sources of information? Where do you go to get good quality, vetted information for parents?
Yeah. So we start by looking at, again, national content contributors who already have really valuable resources and materials for families with young children. And then we work with them to develop that content into translating it into text messaging. A parent or caregiver would receive about 2 messages per week. You get a text message, and then there is a linked landing page so that our parents and caregivers can really choose the level of information that they want to receive. If a 140-character text is enough to get the information, that's great. But if they want to click and get even more resources and understand why that particular topic is important, we have that available as well. And so once we identify who those content contributors could be, we work with them. So we've worked with Nurse Family Partnership, CBS Learning Media, No Kid Hungry. We've worked with 0-3. We recently have started working with Destination Imagination, Big Heart World, really thinking about those social emotional topics.
We're talking to Rebecca Levy with Bright by Text about a program new here in Wisconsin where parents can sign up for these parenting texts related to the age of their kid. Now, Rebecca, this is brand spanking new here in Wisconsin, but it's been operating for quite a while in other states. What kind of impact and response have you been getting?
Yeah, so Bright by Text actually evolved out of a traditional home visitation program that was operated very successfully here in Colorado, where we're headquartered, for over 25 years. And we really just wanted to respond to parents and caregivers where they're at. And we knew that we could leverage this idea of nudge behavior change and doing that through your cell phone. And so in other states where we've operated for several years, we have subscriber recorded benefits. We like to call them our three C's to see how those Bright by Text messages are nudging their behavior, are improving their connections with their child. So we know that 95% of our parents and caregivers indicate that Bright by Text has helped them feel more confident and informed about their child's development. 87% have tried a positive parenting behavior as a result of receiving one of our text messages. And then we also know, again, that local component, 68% report that they have actually connected with their community.
This goes through age 8. Is there a thought of expanding into tween or even teen years in the future?
We definitely get asked that, once a parent or caregiver is getting these helpful information, tips, resources, they want it to go on. And so we currently offer prenatal, so the second trimester of pregnancy through age 8, really getting past that school readiness, as well as when a child transitions from learning to read to reading to learn. And so I think we are through age 8 for the time being, but expanding is not off the table.
And Rebecca, as we wrap up, if there's a parent out there listening saying, I'm in, how do they get on board?
Yeah, so this is a free service for parents and caregivers. And to sign up in Wisconsin, you can text the keyword Badger, B-A-D-G-E-R, to 27448. And if you ever forget that number, when you look at your cell phone, those numbers actually spell out Bright on your phone pad.
Rebecca, thanks for sharing this with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. And we are so excited to bring this service to families across Wisconsin.
That's Rebecca Levy, Program and Systems Director for Bright by Text. She was with us today to share her organization's new partnership with United Way of Wisconsin to bring their parenting advice text service to the state. Again, you could sign up for Bright by Text by texting the word Badger. How are we going to remember that? Badger. And the number is 274-448. Again, 274-448. As we just heard, that spells out Bright on your phone. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's Maureen McCollum with a pair of stories about Good Samaritans.
We're living in a time when things feel so polarized. Us versus them. I'm right, you're wrong. But writer and cardiologist Dr. R.F. Ahmed of Madison wants to remind people there's so much good in the world and that we should take care of one another. He shares two writings about Good Samaritans in his life.
My Jesus Moment, May 2020. A routine plays out at my place of work year after year. I call it my Jesus moment. Every year, I fast during Ramadan. For those not sure, this is a Muslim tradition of no eating or drinking from pre-dawn to sunset for a month straight. It is a spiritual and physical cleansing and reckoning of sorts. Kathy, a colleague of mine, is an excellent pastry chef, a baker par excellence. That she is Christian and married to a pastor adds a little more oomph to this storyline. For years now, I would do the fasting and Kathy would bake a cake and other confectionery for the department to celebrate the end of Ramadan. I bear the brunt for the good of many. My Jesus moment. We get a laugh out of it. Even more, in the world of today, I derive hope out of this. A gift early in the pandemic, April 2020. A world in lockdown, I step out every day to fight an enemy I cannot see. I arm myself by giving to those worse hit than me. I wear my destiny and well wishes and acts of kindness such as these. A gift of hand-sewn caps and masks from my neighbor. Thank you, Bonnie Kenzie.
R.F. Ahmed shared his writings about Good Samaritans in Wisconsin. He also told me why he wanted to pair those stories together.
It is my observation that places where people treat each other well, those nations, communities, and places generally are doing well, and vice versa. Places, nations, communities where people mistreat each other, abuse each other, are not doing so well. So I can extend this a little further. And all religions talk about being a good Samaritan and being rewarded for that. And for abusers, there's punishment. And then when I look around, I see this happening in real time where places with more good Samaritan are getting rewarded and places with more abusers are getting punished. And this, to me, is a sign that God is.
Why do you think it's important to share stories about kindness?
I believe because kindness plays into our happiness. Optimism plays into our mental and physical well-being. And I think it is critical to bring about more of those subjects. One of my writings in the book is actually a critique on the news, which I sometimes feel takes the negative perspective and puts it above the positive take. So I think the positive take, this is the best of America for you in these readings, and I wanted to lay it out.
Dr. R.F. Ahmed is a writer and cardiologist from Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, tap into your creative side with advice from Wisconsin's own Linda Berry. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, where do you get your inspiration from? What does it take to get your creativity going? Our next guest has explored those questions in her own award-winning art and is helping students in Wisconsin find answers through her own work. Linda Berry is the creator of Ernie Pook's Comic, a comic strip that ran for 30 years. She's the author of the award-winning book Making Comics. In 2019, she received a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, also known as a Genius Grant. She's a professor of interdisciplinary creativity at UW-Madison and the 2023 Artist in Residence at Beloit College. I talked to her earlier this year. I want to start with something that I learned from talking to you a long time ago. I think in our lives a lot, we outsource creativity to the, you know, the professional creatives, the artists and musicians. You are really hoping that we reclaim some of our creativity. Can you give us some encouragement to do that?
Well, you know, that's, and especially right now, I think the thing I'm the most interested in is what making drawings can be for people who gave up on drawing when they were little. Most people decide they can't draw at about, it's unfortunate, but it's at about 8 or 9 when they realize they can't draw a nose or hand. And then that's it. They just feel washed up. And for a lot of people, drawing just stops there. But one of the things I'm especially interested in is what happens if you bring drawing back in to the classroom in particular, if you bring it back in, but not with the aim of making a really good picture, but doing something like, for instance, bringing a classroom together. I think a lot of professors and teachers noticed that when the students came back after the pandemic break, people just had a hard time talking. They had a hard time getting together. They had a hard time just socializing in class. And I found out that if I asked them to close their eyes and draw a mermaid for 1 minute without opening their eyes, when they open their eyes, what they've drawn is so shocking and surprising and hilarious to them that the whole atmosphere of the room changes. So one of the things that people can do if they, you know, it sounds like it's not that big of a deal, but if you can close your eyes and draw something for 1 minute, you have to set a timer, you can't stop drawing. I always suggest that people start with a bacon and egg breakfast, because everybody seems to be able to draw that with their eyes closed. And when they open their eyes, they go, hey, I got something going on. And then the mermaid's always hilarious. Statue of Liberty is really good to draw with your eyes closed. So it's all these things that you kind of think you don't know how to draw. When you close your eyes, for people who gave up drawing a long time ago, they can draw longer without stopping with their eyes closed than with their eyes open. Because with your eyes open, you start to argue, like, that doesn't look like the Statue of Liberty. With your eyes closed, you're feeling in the dark. And so that's something that I'm really interested in, how drawing can transform the mood of the room and also the person who's drawing. Like, that to me is amazing. All you do is close your eyes and wiggle your pen for a minute, and when you open your eyes, you feel I had my students draw themselves as Batman today, just doing something that they do in the morning, you know, like Batman making toast or brushing their teeth with their eyes closed. And it was the same thing. It was like they all came in kind of tired. We drew ourselves as Batman with our eyes closed, and then the room was awake. So I find that amazing.
I think I see how that works, because you're talking to me. I gave up drawing. I'm terrible at drawing. But if if you said, Rob, draw something with your eyes open, I'd be like, I can't do it. If you told me, with your eyes closed, the pressure's off all of a sudden, right? Like, Of course I can't draw something with my eyes closed. So, yeah, I'll give it a shot. Is that the kind of response you get from this?
Well, it's actually more, it's deeper than that, because you can't not, first of all, feel kind of crazy when you're drawing with your eyes closed. It's sort of like me telling you to go into a dark room and feel around until you find the figurine of the cat that's in there. So if we filmed you doing that, you'd look pretty crazy. Actually, part of the reason I have people draw with their eyes closed is I just love watching people draw with their eyes closed. The whole class looks like it's dreaming, you know. But then when you open your eyes, it's a kind of surprise that's really wild, because it's so different than what you thought you were drawing. And just that, to get a charge from drawing, and the drawing itself isn't that important. I mean, the drawing itself isn't, I mean, you might want to keep it, you might want to throw it away. You don't have to do anything with it. You can put it in recycling. But it's really, what I've started to find out is, it really is this powerful, powerful thing. And for teaching creative writing, which I also do, you can do a thing where I can read you a story, a short story, and then I'll have you close your eyes and draw a scene from it. And it doesn't seem like anybody could really do that, except for everyone.
Okay.
I've almost never met anyone who can't do that.
I just did the mermaid thing with my eyes closed while you were talking. I got the hair pretty close to the head, actually.
No, that's why it's funny, is because your eyes are closed and then you lift the pen and it's like, where's the face supposed to go? And also, is she wearing like a shell bra? Like, what?
There's, I didn't
like
get that
all
detail.
These things.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, that's it in a nutshell. It's just a strange little thing, but it does surprise people. Today, the other thing I had them draw with their eyes closed, which everyone can do, is a castle. A castle for 1 minute, or a cat. There are all these things that we know the shapes of, and we kind of know the outlines of, but we don't necessarily know that we know that until we give it a try.
I want to throw at you, before we run out of time, there's a line on your Tumblr blog that I really wanted to throw at you and have you expand on. You wrote on a piece of paper, drawing to have an experience rather than make a thing that is good or bad. And I don't know, that just really hit me as something really important. If we're not worried about, this is going to be a product that I'm going to like either be ashamed of or be proud to show people, and do it for the experience. Can you talk about that for a couple minutes?
Sure. Like, say you go on a bike ride, right? And you go on this bike ride and you have a good bike ride and you come home and you feel like you had a really good bike ride. And then suddenly there's a knock on the door, and it's the guys who drive the Google car. Mm-hmm. And they say, did you just take a bike ride? And you go, yes. And they say, how was it? And you go, I thought it was fantastic. And they say, well, let's review the film. So, or let's judge this bike ride by the tracks that your bicycle made. So there are two different things. One is you're in it and you're having a full body experience that actually can change your mood, versus this piece of paper that tells you either did a great job of drawing that castle, or you failed. And neither of those things give you much of an experience, except for an experience of never, ever wanting to do it again. You know, so there's just something to it. And at Beloit College, that's what I'm studying along with my students, because my students, for the most part, there are creative, or they're interested in creative writing. And so what I'm trying to show them is how drawing can help get you there. And also that there's something very similar about drawing and creative writing, in that they deal with images and they deal with your body. And they're very different than thinking, than trying to plan something out. It should feel a little bit like going on one of those funhouse rides at the carnival, or those horror rides. there should be a little bit of terror, but a good terror in it.
Linda, yeah. We'll leave it there. Thanks so much. Good to talk to you again.
It's so wonderful, and I want to just say hi to everybody out in their cars driving home. I listen to this show all the time, and it's just I'm thrilled to think that it's my little voice coming out of people's radios right now.
Well, it's good to hear you again, Linda. Thanks so much. That's Linda Berry, creativity expert, creator of the comic strip Ernie Pook's Comique, artist and teacher at UW-Madison and Beloit College. She joined us today to explore the energy of creativity. If you are the people out there in your car, don't try that eyes closed drawing trick just yet. I'm going to keep doing this. Do you get to see my mermaid? You do not. It's pretty good. Good shot. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, do we need legal limits on social media use for kids? A Wisconsin state lawmaker makes the case that we do and shares a proposed law. And tipping can be confusing. Questions about who, when, and how much to tip. We'll look at the modern world of gratuities and how to make those decisions. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, China stepped up military exercises in response to U.S. meetings with the leaders of Taiwan. An expert on Chinese foreign policy joins us to look at the latest rising tensions in that region and what's at stake for the United States. First, 38 freight train cars derailed and caught fire in East Palestine, Ohio, back on February 3rd. Local residents faced evacuations, and the aftermath of the chemical fires continues to raise health concerns long after residents were allowed to return to their homes. Before derailing, that Norfolk Southern freight train had passed over track sensors intended to alert the railroad to mechanical problems. A new report from ProPublica looks into safety concerns about trains, including the ever-growing length of freight trains and apparent instructions by Norfolk Southern that allow monitoring teams to instruct crews to ignore alerts from those track sensors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the freight trains you see rolling, maybe through your own community? What would you like to see happen to improve freight train safety if you work or have worked on railroads yourself? Do you see anything that worries you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Topher Sanders is a reporter for ProPublica covering railroad safety. Topher, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Topher, that East Palestine derailment I talked about, I think it put a lot of people's attention on rail safety. That's not the first or only incident involving long trains. Can you talk a little bit about the history of what you and your colleagues are digging into at ProPublica?
Absolutely. Yeah, we were able to read through more than 600 investigative reports from the FRA dating back to 2005. And we found that going all the way back to 2005, there were smatterings of incidences involving long trains, enough so that an agency like the FRA, who was being given warning by labor and warning by other industry heads that long trains were coming to the industry and should be paid attention to, that the agency could have been a little bit ahead of where they are right now had they paid attention to that.
Now, the FRA, that's the Federal Railroad Administration. Are they the lead when it comes to regulating the railroad industry?
They are for regulating the railroad industry as far as safety goes. When it comes to commerce, that's the STB, that's the Surface Transportation Board. But for safety, absolutely, it's the FRA.
Now, let's stay with those long trains you were talking about. People might have noticed this anecdotally, but it's the real deal. You report that trains, in fact, have gotten longer over the years, and there are some big business reasons behind that. Can you talk about that growth in just the sheer number of cars on our freight trains?
Yeah, freight trains have gotten far longer than they were. These are not your grandfather's freight trains. They're twice the size, sometimes three times the size that freight trains used to be. And it's a core principle of a new business model called precision scheduled railroading. It's been around for some 6, 7, 8 years, depending upon which company you talk about. And making the trains longer and making sure that they stop less frequently, keeping the trains moving on the tracks, and that length is a part of that. They roll into another shop. Sometimes they don't even rearrange the trains to make sure that they are balanced and put together properly. They just slap what they need to on the back of that train and keep it pushing down the track. And that creates some physics problems that sometimes help cause the trains to leave the tracks.
Now let's talk about the length. I mean, we're talking about trains that are over 1.4 miles long. Did I read this right?
You did. I mean, and sometimes those are the small trains. We've encountered trains that are 3.4 miles long.
You talked to the railroad companies and groups that would respond to your requests and the FRA. The gist is, I think, hey, we don't have a lot of recorded incidents of long trains being responsible for collisions. But then on the other hand, you found that the FRA, the railroad regulator, doesn't track how long these trains are. We just don't have a lot of data on this, right?
That's absolutely right. By and large, there's long trains all over the network. And, you know, you can safely assume those trains are making it to their destination. But that is an assumption. There is no data that's being collected on a proactive basis that really ties the length of trains to any of the incidences that are occurring on our track networks. And that's really needed for us to arrive at, are they safe? How safe are they? Do there need to be changes? We need the data to answer those questions.
You share a story from about 5 years ago, July 2017, train derailment in Hindman, Pennsylvania, that seemed to have some red flags for the future of these long trains. Can you tell us a little bit about this story?
Absolutely. That train has become infamous in train circles. It was a train that was headed through Hyman, Pennsylvania. And as the train left its original destination, it got longer and longer as it was going along its journey. And then it hit one of the steepest grades in CSX's territory. And that's where we started to find the train having problems. The way the train was built, it had a lot of its tonnage and weight at the back end of the train, and in the middle were empty cars, and it went down a steep grade. And as it's going down a steep grade, they used brakes to try to control the train. And those brakes combined with the empty cars in the middle created dramatic physics problems that had the train kind of crushing on itself, and cars popped off of the track, and there was a big explosion, and they had to evacuate that town for 3 days.
Talking to Topher Sanders, reporter for ProPublica, covering railroad safety, talking about his reporting on long trains, on train safety issues after the East Palestine, Ohio derailment. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about how all of this works. If you have observed these long trains coming through your neck of the woods, if you have experience working in this industry and you're listening, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Topher, another piece you focused on safety procedures and cases where apparently by some railroads policy, they say, we don't need to stop and slow down based on some of these red flags we're seeing. What did you find out?
Yeah, that was a story that we did looking at Norfolk Southern's policy, where they have a desk of, you know, smart individuals that get a bunch of data from what they call these wayside detectors. And based on the data they receive, these trains can go by one of these wayside detectors, get an alert that otherwise a crew might need to pay attention to. And if the wayside detector help desk has information that tells them otherwise, they'll tell them just keep on mushing. And there's been some issues with whether or not these detectors are giving the crew the information they need, and whether or not the businesses, the corporation, the railroads are heeding the information coming off the detectors. We identified one accident where they hit one of these detectors, they stopped the train. The crew, I think, had some concerns about continuing with this particular car. They gave the alert. The company, Norfolk Southern, said, keep on. 3 or 4 miles down the track, that train derailed. So that was also in Ohio. So that gives you an indication that sometimes these wayside detectors are giving information that maybe the companies are not heeding.
You also talked to another group of stakeholders, unions that represent the railroad employees. What kind of things did you hear from them about these concerns, both about the long trains and about safety procedures that, you know, might slow things down for the tracks, but might make things a little safer?
Yeah, labor's really concerned about all of this. And that's not a surprise. These are the types of things that labor unions often are concerned about. And what you'll hear from the company side is that those concerns coming from labor are more about generating new job opportunities. But where the truth lies in that is somewhere probably in the middle.
Meaning the labor side of this says, hey, these log trains mean fewer workers. Is that what you mean?
That's exactly right. Right. Long trains mean fewer workers, fewer train starts. And the companies acknowledge all of that. In fact, there was, you know, they cut a bunch of positions when they started rolling out PSR and rolling out these long trains. And the workers say, no, it isn't about creating jobs. It's about creating safe trains. So that's the conversation that's happening between labor and the companies.
Talking to Topher Sanders, reporter at ProPublica, covering railroad safety. We're talking about his reporting and some of the reasons we've seen some disruptive freight train accidents, concerns about longer freight trains with a lot more cars on them, shorter staffing, as we were just hearing, concerns about safety protocols and how they're followed. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions? What do you want to know about train safety, how it is enforced? What are your reactions to this big derailment and chemical fire in East Palestine? How would you like to see freight trains regulated? Do you think some of the concerns are overblown? Do you have experience in the industry yourself? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Topher Sanders, who covers railroad safety for ProPublica. He's sharing his reporting on the relationship between the freight train industry and its regulators and some of the common issues that led up to some of the bigger recent train derailments, including the length of trains. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the length of freight trains? 2 miles plus in some cases? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ralph is with us in La Crosse. Ralph, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what do you want to bring up, Ralph?
I have a question about braking systems. I live in La Crosse along the Burlington Northern Santa Fe tracks, and I've noticed, the same thing, long trains. And frequently we'll see engines on the back of a long train as well as the front. And I think it's got to do largely to maintain air pressure in the braking system, which is really a fairly old system. I know that the rail industry has been recommended to have electronic braking systems, which they're resisted. Theoretically, those electronic brakes probably do a better job. They grab simultaneously. So the question is, how much of the long train problem has to do with simply having an air braking system in it?
Interesting, Ralph. Thanks a lot for the call. Topher, is that a concern you've encountered in your reporting?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the question, Ralph. And, you know, right now, the FRA, credit due to them on this, they're actually doing an extensive braking study at present. I think they're in the last phase of that study where they're going to do some real world modeling to kind of learn as much as they can about the braking systems, particularly in longer trains. I will say that some of the issues that longer trains have when it comes to their train handling and their makeup, a braking system wouldn't mitigate those issues. If the train is built poorly, meaning way too much tonnage in the back, too many empty cars in the middle, is going over wavy, topsy-turvy terrain, your braking system won't be able to help you in those instances because some of those cars are just going to start to crush upon each other. But Ralph's question is a good one. And the distributed power units that he's noticing, those engines on the back, are exactly what he's saying. They are to help create more braking power, but also give the train some more horsepower that it needs to get over its route.
Ralph, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Randy joins us now in Spring Green. Randy, hi.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. Wonderful article. I believe I read the article by the author. Thank you so much. It was very informative in the physics aspect of it. But I hope you'll address the point that when you have these rail sidings, so a train can go the other direction, these long trains, you're trying to put a 1.4-mile long train on a 1.25-mile long siding, and train cars are hanging out the rear end of this siding. And since you don't have cabooses anymore, nor have had them for years, nobody's back there letting somebody know, hey, train coming the other way. We still have some cars on the main line. You better stop. And it doesn't happen. And I've understood from the article that, of course, they have a crash.
Randy, thanks for the call. Topher, yeah, you did report on that.
Yes, Randy's right. And it is one of the earlier problems they observed with long trains is that, hey, man, parking lot's not big enough, basically. And so you had these trains sticking way out in the back. And also how that connects to another issue that many communities are concerned about, and that's blocked railroad crossings, is when you have these long trains sticking out of the siding, it backs up all the way along the line. And that's why you have now with these longer trains, you have more intersections and communities being blocked, because not only can they not get into the sidings, but now they're sticking out much, much further into communities and blocking additional intersections where before maybe they blocked one and you had another intersection you could try to escape to. Now they're blocking two and three.
Thanks a lot for that call, Randy, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Topher Sanders, he covers railroad safety at ProPublica, looking at the freight train industry, the length of trains, the safety issues that they are involved in. Topher, let's get to this East Palestine, Ohio derailment now. Now, this is still being analyzed. We may not have all the answers for a while. What kind of things, though, have stood out to you so far?
I mean, it's all about the wayside detectors in this instance, and in instance for Norfolk Southern specifically, questions about were the thresholds set appropriately for them to be flagged when those ball bearings started hitting a certain heat threshold. And if you listen to the NTSB chairman when she gave her stand up in front of the press, that's one of their key questions. Because it looks like Norfolk Southern's threshold, meaning that, you know, hey, the ball bearing showing this heat level and it should flag the crew when it hits another heat level, that those thresholds were vastly different than the rest of the industry. And that maybe had they been adjusted and been different that night, maybe they would have pulled that train over when it hit that one wayside detector 20 miles away from where the derailment occurred. Maybe they would have pulled the crew over then and had them look at that train, and we would have never heard about East Palestine.
And big picture, it seems like, I don't know if this is fair, it seems like there's a disincentive for crews and administrators to want to report something like that because, hey, maybe it's a false alarm and it's really going to slow down our operations today?
There's some truth to that. Those wayside detectors do give, you know, false alarms. They do sometimes flag issues that aren't issues. Sometimes they've had a train come through, three trains come through, and the wayside detector is flagging the exact same issue on the exact same car on all three trains. And, you know, the probability of that is very, very low. And so sometimes they are malfunctioning and need to be repaired. And then other times they just need to be adhered to. And where the magic is on that is a real question, I think, for regulators. This is an unregulated part of the industry. Wayside detectors, the FRA, has no say on them whatsoever. And maybe they should. Maybe that's something that should happen after East Palestine. Someone should think about what role the government should have in regulating wayside detectors and those thresholds.
That takes me to another part of your reporting. You looked at efforts in Congress in some cases, at the state level and others, to add new regulations to the freight train industry. What kind of things did you find out?
Yeah, it's no dice if you're a state out there and you want to do something to try to regulate the rails. It's just not happening. State after state after state, particularly when it comes to block crossings, attempts to either try to shorten the trains or shorten the duration that the trains can sit at a rail side crossing. And it's just not happening. The state courts will reject it. If it goes to federal courts, they'll reject it. And there have been two attempts to get this into the Supreme Court. One was rejected outright, and the Supreme Court appears to be entertaining the latest attempt, and we'll see where that actually goes. But it is very difficult for states and local government to do anything about the rails if they find them to be a nuisance in their community.
How about at the federal level? Have we seen efforts in Congress to say, okay, we're going to add these new regulatory powers over trains?
Not a whole lot. And that is also the question that Congress is now asking itself after this big accident in Ohio. You're starting to hear voices that you normally don't hear on this issue. You're hearing some prominent Republican voices say that, hey, we're interested in PSR. What is that? Is it dangerous? Those are questions you normally don't hear from that side of the aisle. So maybe there's the temperature is changing and there could be some regulation coming down.
What are you watching for next in your ongoing coverage of railroad safety? What are some of the big open questions in your mind?
I think this question about the length of trains is a big one. Right now, there is a committee at the National Academy of Science doing some very diligent work where they're studying the issue, and they're supposed to come back with a recommendation for Congress after that. So I think that paying attention to what that committee says and what, you know, folks on Congress will do once the committee's done with its work and issues a recommendation. The National Academies of Science is highly respected. So I think that's something to watch in the industry.
And finally, I want to go back to Hindman, Pennsylvania. You talked to some of the people with their personal stories, people who lived near the tracks. Can you share just some of the like experiences they had of that derailment?
That derailment, nobody died in that derailment, mm-hmm. first and foremost. And there was a dog that perished. That was the only casualty of that derailment. It feels like a miracle that that's the case. And so when people reflect on that derailment, there were a lot of near misses. And all of those near misses, you can see it in their eyes. It still sticks with them. One gentleman, he fell asleep on his couch. Had he gone to bed that day, he would not be with us now. And when you talk to him, it's like he's instantly transported back to that moment. He can't even watch the news about train derailments today. So, and everybody we spoke with that was close to the derailment who had to walk out of their front door and see those flames shooting into the sky, had to pack up all of their things, their clothes, and didn't even have time to do that. Just had to throw the kids and the pets into the car and go to hotels that they knew nothing about. All of those moments really stick with that community. And you can see what happens when a train with explosive power flies off the tracks and impacts a community like this.
Topher, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Topher Sanders is a reporter for ProPublica covering railroad safety. You can find a link to his recent stories at WPR.org/Central Time. He joined us today to share his reporting on some of the causes of major train derailments, some possible ways to prevent them, and some of the obstacles toward changes in that industry. Coming up after the news, an expert on Chinese foreign policy joins the show to take stock of recent apparent escalations over the relationship between China on the one hand and the U.S. and Taiwan on the other. By the way, coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, something you might run into from time to time, who should I tip? How much should I give? When do I give? There are a lot of questions, and now sometimes when you use a credit card, say at the coffee shop, you name it, it'll ask you for a tip and different amounts. What is the etiquette? What are we supposed to do when we encounter that tipping situation? You could share your thoughts on that on either side of the counter. Let us know over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.